He could do it, but I don't think he will.
He's not going to do it any more than I will.
Yeah, I said he could.
He could do it. I can tell you something about the psychology of this thing, and it is that you just don't feel you can ever let up for a second. You know, and it makes you sound as if you over-perceive your own role in it. But God damn, every time you turn around, there is something for you to do, you know?
I understand that.
No, I don't think there's any hope of that.
I agree. So the next best thing is, I think, is somehow that he, before GSA gets into this,
mm-hmm.
I'm concerned for a lot of other reasons.
Sure.
But I'm also concerned because of GSA, and that's my immediate worry right now. Before we get into it, one way or another, it would be nice if he could sit down with the Chancellor.
I agree.
Can we facilitate that? Can anybody facilitate that?
I can try. I think what I would be inclined to do is call Barker and simply say, look, man, this is where we're at. I feared it a week ago.
Call the Chancellor.
I could, but this is the thing. I need a real crisis to call the Chancellor for. I have the feeling that you cry wolf, you know. So far, I have been able to get in there every time I've had to, under extreme conditions, but I have made a point not to go in there very often. And, in fact, I may have overreacted even once before.
In this crisis? In this situation?
In this situation. I never talked to Chance until this situation. I mean, occasionally we would meet very briefly for some small thing, but we really didn't know each other until this whole thing began. Well, I mean, in May, till it began.
And
we really haven't seen much. Even in May, we didn't see it. But this time, I've really been going in there because I felt that I had to. And I don't feel comfortable doing it.
I do believe that somebody who he believes completely who he believes is accurately and truly in touch with the students.
I don't know where my credibility is these days.
Well, somebody, it doesn't matter. If you can think of somebody better, fine.
Yeah.
But somebody whom he believes and who he believes understands the student situation has to tell him that Morrison, Melreath, I think
so you just got finished saying basically that Pelton was going to have to make it clear to Addison, Morrison, and people like Reef that he is his own man, that he was not involved in the conspiracy on Monday night and is not now, that he made his decision not under the undue sway of Millett and Metzger. Well, I'm telling you this.
He might even have to, I believe, that I'm telling you what's necessary to gain his credibility back. And he might even have to tell Morrison and Reef almost the impossible thing, namely his opinion of Millett. And he might not have to go into it in great detail.
Yeah, now you see you're coming close to exactly what the problem is. The problem is this, that Morrison and me and a number of other people are loudmouths. And one of the reasons that we have a real credibility problem on this campus in certain areas is because we've told stories we shouldn't have told, you see. For example, among the 500 kids, there are a large number who will tell you right offhand that the president of this institution didn't want this program, which is a distorted view of Henry's position, one that I counter every time I run into it, but it's very widespread, and it comes from things that only a few of us could possibly have known. And so I know that it got to them through Addison, through Morrison, through me. And I must say, it was this very sobering thing to hear that Monday morning after the bust, you know, because you realize that part of the lack of confidence in the whole situation that contributed to what happened last is a result of me, you know. I mean, I felt guilty, and I feel guilty. Now I'm saying this to you. Morrison has no faith in anybody. Pelton can't actually tell him anything in confidence because he has no reason to believe that if the situation gets worse, Morrison will honor the commitment he has made to keep shut on these things. And Morrison's smart enough, I think, in a way, to know that basically he doesn't want to talk to the Chancellor and get anything in confidence because he wants to be able to find those things out independently and be able to say them.
Why does it have to be in confidence? I mean, in terms of...
Because if Mel Pelton says something about just how... All right,
I understand about
you just got finished saying about Millett. All right, that's even obvious, but it's more subtle than that. What if Pelton does tell in some detail how he made his decision? If he does, there are going to be some differences between people's advice to Pelton and Morrison's perception of the situation. And Morrison isn't going to have any scruples at some later date. It's not a question of having scruples. It's a question of forgetting the fact that you first learned these things under a confidential situation. You forget that.
I know.
It becomes a part of your gestalt,
your
view of
standing.
Well,
it's because you hear so much. I understand.
Yeah, no, it's not that.
It is too.
No matter where you pick a fact up, we all have a kind of a mental image of a person or something, and it's impossible to forget where we got that mental image or how it can.
Right.
The whole thing will be colored by what he hears in private, and if he doesn't agree with what he hears, and it's highly likely that he won't agree with the kind of advice he hears the Chancellor got, it's going to color his view of people like William K. Williams. The next thing that could come out of this, very realistic result, is that he will decide Williams is a sellout. I don't know why he hasn't done that already. In fact, what he has done is he doesn't want to believe that, and so basically he has just forgotten what Williams said. He has refused to admit that into his conscious mind. If it's, he's forced to admit it into his mind, it's just as likely that he will label Williams as a sellout as that he will withdraw on his charge that Metzger and Nolan have undue influence. The kid's under severe psychological stress. I know. It's not obvious what he would do with information now that it's given to him. It's all being channeled through a very distorted perception of the situation, from my point of view.
All right, now if the Chancellor tells Mel Reith all of that, and Mel Reith tells Bruce, I don't believe Bruce will think Mel is a sellout.
No, that's true. But he also won't know it so very authoritatively that he'll go around quoting it. But you see, you weren't there last night at dinner, but you see...
Where?
This was at the Union, between 6 and 9. And at about 8:30 or so, Morrison kept saying, "Well, the Chancellor was only in there briefly, but the one thing he said was that if he were on that committee, he would send the kids to B." And Kenny Allen, who sat there and listened to the Chancellor say the same thing, said, "Well, Bruce, that is not what the Chancellor said." And Bruce says, "Yes, it is." And Kenny said, "It is not what the Chancellor said. The Chancellor said that he might even be voting for throwing the whole thing out." And Bruce said, "He never said anything of the sort." And they fought over whether what the Chancellor had said. And earlier than that, West had made the point to Morrison that Morrison ought not go around quoting the Chancellor as having said something unless he really said it. And he said particularly he felt it was important for Bruce not to quote back to the Chancellor something that he had said to Bruce, because people don't like to have things quoted back to themselves, whether or not it is exactly what they said. But as I say, there's nothing sacred in Bruce's mind at the moment. He's all wide open. He's not in a position where he can make decisions to withhold things he received in confidence. And I don't think the Chancellor dares allow anybody know how he made his decisions on Monday night. Because if he does that, he is now not open. He may have bought off the students, but then he is open to attacking the state, you see. There are too many actors in this game for him to play that sort of a game with someone.
Why
like
is he open to attacking the state? I mean, I sense
for
that
mismanagement,
you're right, but
for mismanagement of the university, for taking advice from bad people, for being a chump and not knowing that he had incompetent subordinates and not watching when he did know that he had incompetent subordinates.
Yeah.
The real danger of that, because if Millett gets the axe at a later date, and it turns out now, you see, that Millett has had the Chancellor's ear, then, whether it's true or not, that puts the Chancellor in a bad light. My speculations may be wrong here, but I think the Chancellor would be a fool to tell anybody how he made his decisions Monday night. Particularly tell Addison and Morrison how he made his decisions. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe he's a bolder man than I think. But if I were he and I knew the state Bruce is in, I sure as hell wouldn't do that. I might find some way to calm him down, but it wouldn't be that way.
I don't know any other way.
Well, the other way is to tell him what's going on now. Not what went on Monday night, but what's going on now and how he sees the thing playing itself out. But again, if there's one thing Jack's learned is that half the troubles we're in are for promises we weren't able to keep. And he doesn't really have control over the disciplinary procedures.
Well, at least he can tell him there's no sellout. I mean, there's no prearrangement.
Okay, that's true. That's the kind of thing he has said already. But you see, this isn't being heard. This
is
being heard as
not
a sellout. It hasn't got credibility.
It's being heard, but not believed.
That's right. That's exactly right. He has said things like that, like, "I want them to go through the usual disciplinary channels of the university, and they must be handled properly, and I'm not making deals behind the scenes." He said that. But that sounds like a deal, you see. The point is, the curious thing is that kids, Morrison and Addison, are more concerned essentially about the state, and they credit the state's opinion as having a greater influence upon the Chancellor than I think the Chancellor himself feels the importance of the feeling out in the state. They are overreacting to the state, and the Chancellor is walking a fine line, but he's doing a better job than they think he's capable of. I guess what it basically boils down to is they are thinking that if they were the Chancellor, they would be giving in to that kind of pressure. They are basically saying that they would, and they don't believe that he's a better man than they are.
Well, I'm not sure that's what they're saying.
I think that is what they're saying.
No, I don't, but that's all right. I won't argue that.
Maybe, but I think Morrison feels that he's enough of a politico not to believe that any other politico has principles.
No, I think it's much simpler than that. And that is that the reason that they believe that he's giving into the state is that they believe he gave into Millett.
Oh, okay. Yeah, okay, that's
anybody
right.
Believe
that
any, you know,
that's
they,
right.
So they're gone.
That's
their belief in his strength of will is gone.
Well, but you see, here's what I think is the danger. Neither of us may be right, but I'm afraid, you see, that if you put out the Millett-Metzger fire, they will simply shift their basis for belief to something else. Are you following me? What I'm saying is that it may be impossible to get confidence back in the Chancellor because they may not want to believe at this point that he's doing the right thing. And if you convince him, if you think, for example, that the keystone of their case against him is the undue influence of Millett and Metzger, I'm betting that if you beat that, some other keystone will pop right in there in a hurry. You may be fighting. In other words, I'm saying it may not be possible to dissuade him.
I still believe that somehow, maybe even over a series, maybe it'll take a period of time, like, you know, 2 weeks,
week and a half, two weeks, whatever,
but that somehow direct communication between the Chancellor and these people will essentially convince them that the Chancellor is straight.
Yep. Well,
and that is the only thing that will convince
them. Bill, I couldn't agree with you more. I think maybe if one could arrange now for the Chancellor to have lunch every day to the near future. I don't think it takes that much. But the point is, it maybe not take that much, but that would do it. This isn't a question of actually what is conveyed. It's a question of being open and being above board and being available to answer questions whenever they're presented. And just knowing that tomorrow he's going to be there is going to keep people calm tonight, no matter what night it is, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, that's good.
On the other hand, that's a tremendous time drain on that guy's schedule at the moment.
Well, of course.
To suggest a thing like that is to make a very violent suggestion, you know.
It's not a bad idea.
No, I think it's a great idea. I think it would work. Question is this particular problem, that of Morrison and Anderson, the biggest one or the one that he should devote that much time to? I don't know. You see, I don't know what else. I think I'd agree that it was. I would make my plea. But I would not get myself psyched up the way Morrison did on Monday night and say this is the only solution.
No.
But let's try that one. I'm willing to try that one. Have the Chancellor have lunch every day. Or at least meet every day at some time around lunch, maybe. You know, he probably has other appointments he would have to cancel, which would be bad. But let him have lunch every day with these guys.
Yeah.
Morrison?
I don't think that'll work.
You don't think it will?
No, I'll tell you why. It almost works. I'm trying to think of the necessary modification. The reason it won't work is because if he has lunch, let's say it's Morrison, Addison, and Reef, just for the hell of it.
Yeah.
I don't know who it is, but assume that those are the three people.
Yeah.
If he has lunch every day with Morrison, Addison, and Reef, John Lee Johnson, Vic Berkey, who else? I don't care. Are going to, you know, they're over there somewhere.
There's one thing we got going for us, which is that the even at this point, even Berkey is saying that the 500 program comes first. And I have been able to stop people like CRJ and Berkey by saying, maybe the thing you have just proposed is a wonderful idea, but I think you ought to check with the kids first or with Addison first because it's their thing.
Yeah, that's fine. But
that so far has worked, and so I'm suggesting that maybe it's okay as long as Addison's in there.
Okay.
Because so far, thank God.
But you understand the problem that I was suggesting.
Yeah. Okay, well, I'll put it this way. I think Berkey has no right to have anything to do with this thing. And
well,
I know. Berkey, in a way, knows that.
I'm not really worried about Berkey.
Right. Berkey's no problem.
Cornib
should sit on this thing. I think that's right. It seemed incomplete to me, and I couldn't figure out why. Cornib is exactly the man who ought to be there. Cornib, Addison, and Morrison. I think that's appropriate. They're the heads of the BSA, the GSA, and the student government. If John wants to be there, they will have to decide that. But I think that my proposal to the Chancellor would be those three. I think none of them would object to the presence of John Lee Johnson.
I think none of them would either.
You know,
the only question is if John Lee Johnson were there, would the Chancellor be as honest? I'm not expecting the Chancellor to bare his soul under any circumstances.
Yeah.
It'll be a cumulative thing.
Absolutely. This is a process. This is absolutely a process. It's a chess game. And you know, a certain amount of information must be revealed to either side. When you make a move, you sort of give away your strategy, and this gets this game. I don't know how to answer that, except to say that I've watched Johnson in this thing, and he's been one of the most positive actors on the
show. Oh, yeah, I think he's been fabulous.
He's fantastic.
No, I agree.
I saw him in the BSA office Thursday of that week explaining to Addison how the financial problem came about.
Yeah, no, I think he's been fun.
Johnson knew exactly the dates that the things were going out. You know, he was basically saying that these things were not malicious, that no one wasn't sitting up there trying to kill the program shoving the money away. He was serving an extremely positive function.
No, I agree that
so I would have no fear about John Lee.
I have no fear about him. No. I'm asking about the Chancellor.
Well, if he does, he shouldn't. Okay. Mm.
The only way that that'll get accepted, incidentally, is that, well, the thing that has to be told the Chancellor must understand what... what his position is in these guys' minds. I don't. He may have a hard time believing it. I think because you know it's so extreme right now.
I know. Well, it's. I wish you could have been at William Williams' house the other night because I could show you in my transcript where the hysteria began, and it was really a case of hysteria.
If that happens again, let me know.
Well, I mean, yeah, I didn't. I kind of crashed it myself in a way, but yes, I will. There's nothing anybody could have done because there weren't the facts.
Mm.
All we had to go on were their surmises, and
mm-hmm.
to them it was the gospel truth. And to even give a counter surmise was to open yourself for extreme attack. John Saltiel was there, and he kept screaming at me to shut up. You know, he demanded that the crowd, that the other people there, force me to shut up several times. And I finally gave up, but all I was trying to do was say, are these things you're saying really true? Aren't there alternative explanations that you ought to investigate before you take drastic action?
Yeah.
And I know how that sounds to Saltiel. I had no power.
Yeah.
The only way I've ever been able to win with guys like that is to know the facts that they don't know. I beat Berkey, I think, at 6 o'clock on Tuesday because I knew what he didn't know. He hadn't done his homework. Maybe I didn't even beat him, but I mean, I held my own anyway.
6 o'clock on Tuesday?
Yeah. You know, there was a meeting last Tuesday at 6. There was one at 2. See, the bus were at 3 in the morning. Then at 8 o'clock, the press release went out, but it was also asking for a rally at 2, which there was. Maybe it was at 2. No, I spoke at 2. I just gave a speech. At 6, we were all back in there, and Berkey started waving the flag.
Where?
Back in the South Lawrence line of the union. Quite a crowd, incidentally. This was the night they were going to close the union, decided not to do that. So there we all were. Well, Berkey, I wish I had a transcript, because he made some remarks, and then I got up and said I didn't think that the picture that had been painted of the administration was quite the right one, that I was all for admitting, and in fact for insisting, that there had been bungling, that they had been woefully inefficient, that they had handled these black students about the way they handle white students all the time, which we know about. But as far as maliciousness and things of that sort, I wasn't willing to attribute those things. Well, Berkey stood up a little while later and said, you know, this Eisenman guy bothers me. He bothers me, the way he does it. Goes, he's been around a long time, and I can't quite figure his game, he says. He says, he always presents the administration picture better than the administration. You know, he gets a great hand on that. It's a great line. See? And then he went on like that, and then he went away from the microphone. So I immediately hopped up. Well, Goss was chairing the meeting, and he was being very good about it, and he let me have the microphone. He said, are you people going to put up for a debate between these two? Because it's what we're getting into very quickly here. And the answer was predominantly yes. And I said, thank you very much. I said, I feel I must answer this ad hominem attack. I said, I think I'd like first to point out that having the distinction of having been fired by Dean of Students, Stanton Miller, that probably makes me an administration stooge, you know. And I got a good laugh out of that one. And then I turned on Berkey, and I started asking him questions. You see, he had attacked, perhaps justly, certain elements in my story of what had happened the night before. One of them being that there wasn't really any panic until 3 in the morning when the police dogs were outside and everything. Or I had given that picture of it. And he was saying that there had been panic at 8 or something, or there hadn't been panic at 8, or whatever it was. Anyhow, there had been an obvious inconsistency in his remarks, and I called it to the attention of the crowd, and he had to shrug his shoulders. And then basically I sat down. But I had him.
On the facts.
I had him on the facts,
yeah.
Right? And I had him on the facts, and I had him on the fact that he didn't know much about me yet, and then I was able to roll out my favorite thing. But it isn't easy.
What favorite thing?
Being fired by Stanton Miller. It's one of the great feathers in my cap.
Yeah.
It isn't even true. I was not really fired.
No.
I resigned, but I was ordered out of my office, which I consider tantamount to being fired.
I believe that's about as close as you can get.
Correct. Of course, Miller, of course, is just dumb enough so that he will go out sometime and contradict my story and say that he never fired me. You know, although he doesn't realize that this story is one of the things that's very important to my credibility at the moment, which is in his interest if he only knows it. He hasn't got a whole lot of interest, but relative to the things that could happen to him, I'm not the worst. And, still, he'll be dumb enough to give us a fight on that. Well, I don't know. I think there's something in the chance of having lunch every day with Morrison, Adams, and Cornyn, but I think that's not too unreasonable. It's going to be a terrible demand on his schedule, you know. I mean,
it doesn't even have to be lunch, you know. Morrison, Adams, and Cornyn can go to his office and have coffee with him for 20 minutes.
Yeah, every day. Till this is over with. Yeah.
After lunch, between lunch.
Yeah.
What? Doesn't matter.
Yeah, or coffee, yes. Lunch is kind of extreme. That's an hour and a half. Coffee for 20 minutes. The only thing wrong with that, though, is if there's something substantive that they want to accomplish, you see. If they go in there with a real gripe and he has to find out something about it. Maybe coffee for 20 minutes and the possibility of a meeting later in the day.
Right.
Possibility of another 20 minutes at 5. In other words, what I think I would do is recommend to the Chancellor that he set up permanent coffee for 20 minutes from 11:40 till noon every day, but that he also privately, without announcing it to these people, arrange to be free at 5, between 5 and 5:20, so that any time they bring something up he can't act on, he can tell them we'll come back at 5 and we'll do it. I think he should make a point to leave himself open for that. If he schedules himself in tight,
then he's
in a bind. The thing is, 5 hours ought to be enough time for Barker or somebody to figure out what the hell the facts are if there's something that's bothering people. Well, I think something like that would be extremely positive, and I'm all for calling you up right now and trying to do it, so why don't we do that?
I can't say very much.
I've just had the conversation with Lucius Barker on the phone, and we have agreed to compare notes before 10 o'clock on Monday. Lucius apparently had another phone call to the effect that the Chancellor's credibility was going down the drain, that the role of Metzger and Millett was of great concern, and he reacted very negatively to my suggestion that the Chancellor meet every day for 20 minutes with Morrison, Addison, Cornum. I think on the grounds that the man's schedule is very busy and that unless there were a real reason for meeting, he shouldn't. He felt that the Chancellor should be open to meet with him for any length of time, any time they needed to see him, but that to set up a regular meeting like that would be a waste of time. I feel quite differently and tried to explain this to him, but I didn't push the thing too far. Now, Bill and I have been talking about various people's roles in this thing, in particular mine. I've just taken him in and we've looked at the position board in Pines' office. And I was making the point, I said that that my role was rather similar to that of a labor mediator, and Bill made the very point that I'm not, I'm certainly not perceived that way by most of the people, and I'm definitely perceived as a participant. And then I said that certainly my self-interest was not obvious, and he is now about to say something about that.
the point is that the self-interest is no longer what I said, and what I really sums it up is that self-interest is no longer a criteria necessary to be regarded as a participant. That is, people, Morrison and Addison and everybody, I think almost, can't speculate about the administrators, but you know, no longer regard the administrators as participants on the grounds of their self-interest, or anybody else as participants on the grounds of their self-interest. They regard them as participants because of something that they are into, you know, that they have, and that's the first reason why you are, most certainly a participant, because you have been into the thing for too long to now step back and say, I'm going to take a historical perspective, and nobody really believes that you're taking an historical perspective. The second thing that happens is that you are regarded, I have to be careful because I don't want to give the wrong impression, not as a flunky, as an adjunct to the administration of the program.
Mm-hmm. Of the program, not of the university.
Of the program, not of the university.
Yeah.
And that for this reason, they do believe you when they say that your self-interest is in continuing the program. Where your credibility comes into doubt is the possibility that you may believe, which you may even maybe be true, I don't know, that it is necessary for the good of the program. It may be necessary for the good of the program to sacrifice principles and deal with the administration on the grounds that the administration are going to be doing the program anyway, and that a schism between you and the administration or someone else connected with the program in the administration can only result in disaster for the program.
Oh, that's curious. Never occurred to me.
But it's certainly very possible. I mean, it may never occur to you, but it's certainly very possible. It seems to me a very tenable position, in fact, to hold that.
In other words, they think that basically
they don't really think any of these things.
Yeah.
I think
that the perception is that is something like this, that if I were to split with the program.
If you were to split with the administration, if you were to say, with Morrison and Addison and whoever.
Burn it down, yeah.
Not burn it down.
All right.
Don't be that. You don't have to be that extreme.
Okay.
Simply say together with them, the administration bungled because Millett's influence is too strong and the Chancellor has been acting in a weak fashion. If you were to say with them that, you thereby remove yourself from the program as it now exists, and it's impossible from the instant that you say that, it is impossible from that time on for you to function in the program anymore, because the administration will not have you. Under those circumstances.
You think that's really what people think? In other words, you suspect that if I were to come out tonight and announce that Millett and the company had bungled miserably and the Chancellor has acted in a weak fashion by accepting their bunglings and not drumming them out for them, that would immediately increase my credibility with
No, I don't think it would increase them.
Do anything for my credibility.
It wouldn't do anything. I'm not saying that that's the way to
recruit.
I'm saying that that's the reason why
That would be a totally unexpected act on my
yes.
part. Yeah, let's not back into that.
No, I've done that twice now.
Yeah, well, I shouldn't be there. I have a table was taken out of here. That's interesting. I subscribe to that position. I basically feel that Millett and company have sold the thing out, and I do feel that the Chancellor has acted weakly, that basically somehow or other he should have known last summer that his people were going to bungle it.
Well, I'm being more specific in saying that. I mean, make it more specific.
That right now he's acting
weakly. That he acted weakly Monday night, if you were to somehow declare the tenets of the hypothesis that they put forth, that would be, completely unexpected.
In other words, they don't think I can do that. They think that I have an investment in not saying something of that sort.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, they're right. I do.
Right.
Okay, so this is true.
Yeah. I don't think I don't think their perception of your position is really wrong.
Okay, all right.
The only thing that I'm concerned about is from what you said in there that your perception of it was wrong. And I think that's not the case now.
Well, let's come back to that a little later. What I'm getting at here now is that I think those things, but not for the reasons that you put forth. It's not because I care so much about the 500 program that I wish to whitewash the Chancellor and Millett and Company. It's because I don't think that they're as dirty as they've been made out to be.
Right, I understand that.
There's a difference. And I base, again, you see, is the only way I feel I can hold credibility is if I have facts that show that, in fact, they're not as dirty as they're being made out to be. And I've won several rounds on that basis, you see. Because
I'm talking to you now.
I don't know if you were there. If you were there, were you in the when we were drafting the statement that was printed at 8:00 in the morning? Were
no, I wasn't there.
Okay.
I did not arrive until Thursday.
Yeah, let me pause here and just tell you what went on at that office at that time.
Yeah.
I have just told Bill all about what happened early Monday morning. And about the draft, we have gone over this statement that we came out with, what happened and why. Hi. We'll close the door because we're making a lot of noise.
Actually, sounds interesting. You're talking about the 500? A guy. We have to realize I sort of move in a sort of radical milieu, so it's going to be it's going to be an average radical version.
Well, that's what we want. That's fine. I mean, I think it's useful to trace.
Yeah. Anyway, this thing started late in June. They were going to have a lot of students, a lot of black students, approximately 500. There was one initial promise that's been not fulfilled and also not pressed by the black students, and that's the quota from the North End here in Champaign, but that's been dropped by all concerned.
Yeah.
And anyway, the black students that came here were told that they were going to have to borrow a maximum of $470 and that they wouldn't have to work. And apparently this was not put in writing.
Mm-hmm.
As far as anybody, at least at SDS, knew, it was not in writing. And so when they came here, they were given this orientation, and there was a grievance about housing by some girls, et cetera, because they were moved out of the original orientation housing into some pretty crappy areas.
Mm-hmm.
But that grievance was fulfilled, but it's been presented as the main reason for this outbreak, when the main reason is the situation of having to work and also the business of having to take out loans for three times as much as they originally thought that they'd be responsible for. And that was the reason
that you didn't get
all the grievances for the reason.
Right.
And then you had the gas, the Peltison or whatever his name was back in town by 8:00 by 8, I think, from Kankakee, knew about it, and was even some reports, even from university security types, that he was in the union, but refused to go down and speak to them for the supposed reason he didn't want another Columbia, not being clear how this reasoning holds.
Yeah. So his motivation.
Since he should have gone if he didn't want another Columbia, in any case, you know.
Yeah, it's really very funny that you happen to come out of just continue. This happens to fit right in with exactly what we're discussing.
Well, one guy said that a security officer told him that he was in the building that night. That night, the guy had told him he had come down.
Mm-hmm.
This is a white SDS type.
Yeah.
And they knew Peltison was around, etc. So they finally decided 1:00 was going to be a deadline. there was some chair breaking earlier, not very much, and then at 1 o'clock at the deadline there was some more, the chandeliers and stuff. Probably no more than 10 to 15 students were actually in it. And then the cops came on en masse from every possible source. And as it's been reported that it was a grievance over housing, which was immediately, taken care of, and somehow the reporting of the original money and work problem was not at all, has not been even taken up by the bureaucracy since then. The only thing that has been taken up is the instigation of the disciplinary procedures.
Oh, so there was no perception that anything had been done about the money or the work?
Let's see. Now, about the work, the perception was that nothing had been done. I think the feeling was that about the money was that some the bureaucracy was moving inefficiently and slowly, but that the point was that even though there obviously isn't any obvious order from above, that you have certain people in bureaucracies that are racist and